Hello and welcome to another episode of eDiscovery Chicks, the podcast about all things eDiscovery and legal tech, hosted by two gals who are having a total Monday of a Tuesday. Anyways, we're your hosts. That's Bree.
And that's Angie. And today we're talking about the BTK killer and specifically how the metadata on a single floppy disk, do we even know what that means? Fell that monster. But before we get to that, how are you doing? And by the way, Angie, you look like a freaking movie star goddess right now.
Well, thank you for saying that. It's amazing how good people think you look when you set the bar really low on a day-to-day.
Oh, please. You are so full of crap.
But I actually put on like lipstick and eyeliner because I'm going to dinner after this. And
oh,
so,
nice.
Yeah.
So where are we going to dinner tonight? I need to know all the deets.
Yes. So when you come and visit me in Seattle, I will take you to this place. So we are going to a local restaurant called Lady J, and they specialize in smoked meat and craft cocktails. Typically, it's a pretty like relaxed environment. Scratch that. It's a very relaxed environment. We can comfortably take our toddler there. But tonight, the chef is dipping his toes in fancy food. And so there's like a five-course Wagyu and whiskey.
Oh my gosh.
Wagyu beef and whiskey pairing. And so that's what we're going to
after. Oh my gosh.
Like even the dessert is some sort, it's whiskey or Wagyu fat washed cookie crumble something or other.
Oh my God.
Yeah. I mean, it's just going to be decadent and amazing.
You're speaking all of my love language.
I know. I ate the saddest little salad for lunch today, and I was just sitting there thinking, I'm conserving space.
I'll have three leaves, please.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, my God. Well, how's your Monday, Tuesday going?
Oh, my day is absolutely ridiculous. Can I tell you that I'm pretty sure the universe thinks that I ate like a little baby kitten because not only am I carless because of our accident that happened when you were in town.
Yes.
I also had somebody steal money from my checking account. Apparently, somebody went on a shopping spree at Ticketmaster for like some...
At Ticketmaster?
Yeah, for some comedy jam tour or something. I have been having to not only deal with the scandal with the car, but now we have a scandal with the bank. And I'm like, well, what the heck? And my husband and I are having this debate, which is hilarious. But my son's going to be 13 very soon. And I'm like, okay, dude, whatever car we buy is going to be his car. And he's like, absolutely not. And so we've had this whole conversation of like, well, what was it like when you were 16? I'm like, when I was 16, I was driving a piece of crap that my dad like gave me a few hundred bucks towards. And I had to like buy the rest of it. And it broke down all the time, like in bad places in town.
Yeah,
like
deeply unsafe.
Yeah, no, it was like the worst, absolutely the worst car you could ever put your teenage daughter in. My dad was like, yeah, sounds good. I don't have to pay much for it. But let her go. She'll learn. Like, I don't want to do that, but I also don't want to just gift him anything either. So we both like came to the conclusion that he's going to have to work for all the things and he's going to have to know that it's not really his car. It's a shared car situation and he can ask to use it.
So, I love that.
But, you know, we still have 3 years to work this out. So lots of
things. Oh, my God. I feel like my first car was a 1995 Toyota Camry that my dad bought for like, same deal, a couple hundred bucks. Mm-hmm. And it was just the side of it, the person who'd owned it before me had gotten in some sort of massive accident. And so the rear panel by the trunk was just totally caved in.
Oh, man.
And the leather on the seats, I don't know how this happened, but it was all ripped up and stuff. And it was just, you know, just a beater car.
That's so nice. Mine was a 1981 Mercury Lynx, which nobody knows what the fuck that is, but it's like an old Ford Escort kind of station wagon hatchback thing looking thing.
I know what it is.
It has a manual stick shift that has four speeds.
Yes. Four. Yes. Yes. You're limited by the car itself.
And by the way, I cannot even imagine teaching a teenager how to drive a stick shift as much as I give my dad, like God bless his soul, because he had to teach me how to drive a stick shift.
Oh, I destroyed the clutch on my mom's car, I think. Like that thing never ran right after they taught me how to drive.
But I feel like it's kind of like cursive. Like you kind of should learn it because you never know if we ever have to go back to it.
This is why I feel like I need to know how to ride a motorcycle or drive a motorcycle too, because what if it's my only means of escape?
Oh my God. If I can only escape on a motorcycle, I am so screwed.
Oh, yeah, totally. Like, I'm just dead. I'll just like be a possum at that point and see if that gets me anywhere, because I don't even know how to start it.
Oh my God. I'm going to have to like hitch a ride with somebody who doesn't mind having a big old grandma on the back. I'm like, bro, pump me, like back in the 80s when I had like my bicycle. Can you pump me, man?
Can you pump me, man, please? Oh, boy. Okay. Well, shall we get this moving along?
We have an exciting episode and people are already buzzing about it. It's so exciting.
I'm so excited. So like Bree said, today we are talking about the BTK killer. We are going to start with a brief history of the case. We're going to touch on the BTK killer. His name is Dennis Rader. We're going to touch on some of his crimes, but what we're mainly going to focus on is how he was caught. Because after a 30-year cat and mouse game with law enforcement, the BTK killer made a critical error, which put some metadata in law enforcement's hands, which ultimately led to his capture. So before we get into that, like I said, we're not going to go too deep into his crimes themselves. There are other podcasts and other resources that talk about that, and you should listen to them, especially those that the victims' families have endorsed. So today, we are really going to focus on the e-discovery component of this case. All right, but before we get into all of that, we do want to offer a quick trigger warning to our listeners. This episode will touch on aspects of violent crime. We'll touch on aspects of torture and murder. And so if that is something that is a trigger for you, we encourage you to do whatever is best for your mental health. Even if that is skipping this episode, there will be no hard feelings.
None at all. And so not only are we going to talk about the BTK killer, but we're also going to focus on how digital forensics and metadata analysis played a crucial role in bringing him down. So this case actually is a landmark for digital forensics and e-discovery. Angie, I know, and you guys, I love true crime, but and I thought that I love true crime like with all my heart, but then I met Angie and I'm like, no.
Oh God.
She actually is way in on this stuff, guys. So I'm going to let you, Angie, give us a little bit of the background, if you don't mind.
Oh, okay. All right. I'll give you the amuse-bouche part of this. So
little spoons, please.
Little spoons, please. So Dennis Rader, who is infamously known as the BTK killer, which is short for bind, torture, and kill. This dude was really the embodiment of a double life. Like, you think about all those creepy people that you hear about on the internet or in your true crime documentaries that truly live a double life. That's this dude. On the surface, he looked like a devoted family man. He was a respected church leader and a trusted Boy Scout volunteer in Wichita, Kansas. He also held a steady job as a compliance officer, where his strict authoritarian approach mirrored the disturbing control he exerted over his victims. Now, behind this seemingly normal facade lurked a calculating predator who meticulously planned his attacks, stalking his victims for weeks before striking with chilling precision. His ability to compartmentalize his dark impulses allowed him to evade law enforcement for decades, all while feeding his narcissistic need for recognition by taunting the media and police with cryptic letters and disturbing clues.
So Rader terrorized Wichita, Kansas from 1974 to 1991, murdering 10 people. His first crime was the murder of the Otero family in 1974. Rader was highly organized, selecting victims and observing them before attacking. He often broke into homes ahead of time or used deception to gain entry. He overpowered his victims. He restrained them. He terrorized them before killing them, often through strangulation and suffocation.
Do you want to hear a creepy story before we continue?
I mean, like, that's not creepy enough.
I mean, that's very creepy.
Okay.
So in college, I dated this guy named Jake, and his dad was a police officer in Washington. There was one night in the 90s where his dad was on patrol and got just kind of a weird feeling. And they lived sort of out in the country a little bit. And so his dad was like, you know what? I'm just going to do a cruise by my house, check on my wife and my little baby. And so he drove past the house and he noticed that a light that was typically on the outside of the house was off. So he goes to check it out. Turns out, this is the 90s, right? So no cell phones. Phone lines had been cut. The back window to their house had been broken and there was a milk crate underneath it. And then that light bulb had been shattered.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Talk about terrifying, right? So that's sort of the type of thing that BTK killer would do. He would stalk his victims and sort of do that pre-planning thing. But yeah, isn't that creepy?
That's super creepy. Ugh.
So back to BTK. Like a lot of serial killers, Rader wasn't content with just committing the murders. He actually wanted credit for them, and he really craved the attention and acknowledgement that some of these more infamous serial killers had gotten over time. So he wanted that same attention from media and police. And so in 1974, this is the year that he started his crime spree, he began sending letters to police and newspapers detailing his crimes, gruesome detail, the kind of things that, you know, only the killer would know. And he personally coined the name BTK, bind, torture, kill, to brand his crimes. Now, I feel like that's just a special level of narcissism where you feel like you have to give yourself a moniker like that. Anyways, okay, so the letters that the BTK killer sent, they included word puzzles, cryptic messages, and even drawings that challenged the police to catch him. He continues playing this cat and mouse game, kind of taunting law enforcement for decades. Allegedly, this was because he believed himself to be intellectually superior to them. So he followed the media coverage of BTK killer super closely and demanded more recognition for his murders as the years went by. But despite his taunts, the forensic limitations of the time prevented police from tying him to his crimes.
So then he went silent. From 1991 to 2004, nobody hears anything. After his last known murder in 1991, Rader vanished from the public eye. Authorities suspected he had died or moved away, or I guess he stopped killing. There's many speculations as to why he disappeared. He had a family, he had a job, like maybe he was busy with that. Maybe it changed some of his psychological, whatever issues were throwing him off. Maybe the control that he was seeking was somehow satisfied, or his compulsion to kill no longer existed. Who knew? Or maybe it was just even the increased risk that he might get caught. There's a lot of speculation. Who knows what really was? I mean, he's a sick guy, obviously. There's no telling.
No telling. All right, let's talk about that increased risk of getting caught, because his overconfidence actually led him to make a fatal mistake. After he vanished from the public eye in 1991, nobody hears anything from him until 2005. But that year, he resumed communicating with the police and the media, and he sent more letters and puzzles and disturbing souvenirs from his crimes just to taunt investigators. But this still wasn't enough for him. Remember, this guy just craves attention. He's a bottomless pit for it. And so he wanted a more efficient way to communicate. And he asked detectives if a floppy disk could be traced back to him. Now, for people who are younger than 30, a floppy disk is, oh my God, I don't even know how to describe it. It's like a thumb drive, but like earlier than that. And it's like a little square.
Well, if you're as old as me, you had a real floppy disk that actually was flexible. Like back in the day, when I was in elementary school, I remember we had one Apple computer and the disks that you would put in it were like actually very flexible.
Floppy.
Yeah, they were actually floppy. But that's not the same disk that he used, but it's kind of like a, I don't know. I mean, I'm trying to think like what I can compare it to. It's about the size of a deck of cards. But very, very flat and skinny. And you would like stick it into your computer like you would like a DVD into a DVD player, if you know what that is.
And then your computer would go,
that's right. And there's a very limited amount of information that you could put on a floppy disk. But anyhow.
Which is why you typically have dozens of them, preferably in many different colors.
Of course, and pretty little labels and all the things. But y'all can Google it and figure it out for yourself.
So anyways, police assured Rader that the floppy disk would be safe to use. And that's how they baited him into making this error.
Okay, first of all, why would you? This is like a Tom and Jerry episode. Like,
I know.
Why would you trust the mouse if you're the cat? Like, seriously?
I don't know. I mean, and get this, in one of his letters to police, he actually directly asked them if the floppy disk could be traced back to its sender. And he goes, quote, be honest.
Wow. I didn't even know that part. Interesting. Yeah. So the floppy disk ultimately betrays the BTK killer. So Rader took the bait. He mailed a purple floppy disk to KSAS TV in Wichita, Kansas. So the disk contained a file labeled testa.rtf, a brief message from BTK. What Reader didn't realize is that every digital file contains metadata. Despite his belief that deleting files would remove all traces of his identity, digital forensic tools were capable of recovering residual data left behind in the disk's memory sectors. Dun, dun, dun.
Okay, so how did that forensic examination work? Like, walk me through that.
I love talking about forensic examination.
I know you do.
Well, first of all, I'm going to say, number one, I am not a forensic expert. And I'm saying this because I know so many forensic professionals who I have amazing like appreciation for all the things that they do. And so I'm not going to pretend that I am one of those, but I can tell you that I know enough to be dangerous. So we're going to get the high level version today.
Stop undercutting yourself, you beautiful badass.
Oh my God. All right. Typically, these are the steps of how a file recovery process would be done. First of all, you're going to create a forensic image. So the investigators would take the disk and they would use tools like FTK, which is short for Forensic Toolkit, or Encase or Magnet. Those are all different software programs that are on the market today that do this. But they would take those tools and they would use them to make that image to avoid altering the original evidence. This ensures that all data, including deleted files and metadata, are preserved for further analysis. Then they use some file carving techniques. And that's kind of like what it sounds like. It's like carving into the data to figure out what the heck happened. Using the forensic software, they can search for deleted data remnants. Even when a file is quote unquote deleted, the actual data remains on the disk until it's overwritten. Tools can be used to recreate these files, or enough remnants can be available to piece together the story. So they were able to uncover the hidden agenda file. It contained an agenda for a meeting at Christ Lutheran Church in Park City, Kansas. Which, by the way, it makes me very freaked out that some dude that has a family and a job and is going to church is also like slicing and dicing people in the dark. Like, that's freaking weird. Yeah.
Just like how his data was sliced.
Exactly.
For our listeners, like a little bit more background, I'm pretty sure this is how this worked on floppy disks. This is like just sort of a rule of thumb, is that there's deleting and then there's double deleting. And if you delete something on your computer, you just like put it in the trash or whatever. It's not gone. It's just sort of in a different space on your hard drive. And you have to actually go in and double delete it for that to be gone. And then when Bree's talking about remnants, your hard drive or whatever you're saving to is made up of bits. So just think of them like sections of an orange or something like that. And then if you fill them up and then only delete part of them, you're going to have stuff like left over in that section. And those are the remnants that people can piece together.
Yes. And we'll talk about this more in a moment. But when we're talking about remnants of like double deleted files or purge files on a PC, there's also things like shell bags and linked files. There's like little tiny remnants of information that can all be pieced together to tell a story. And that's essentially what happened. They took this disk, they made a forensic image of it, they found all those remnants and pieces, and they were able to link together the story and figure out that he had tried to delete something, but it wasn't securely wiped, so they could find that file on the disk. So what they were able to see on the floppy disk, number one, the username. The document's properties revealed that it had last been saved by a user named Dennis. Well, hello, we know who you are. Organizational details, references to the church indicated an affiliation with a specific community in Kansas, and also timestamps. The file's creation and last modification dates provided a timeline that aligned with Raider's communications with law enforcement. So what we're trying to tell you is that the remnants of the deleted file contained metadata, the fields in the metadata, the username, the organizational details, and the timestamps were enough information to lead law enforcement in the right direction to find Dennis Reader.
Whoop, that's right. So they now had a direct link between BTK's taunting messages and a real person named Dennis associated with a specific church. This is the turning point in the case because it allowed authorities to narrow down their suspect list significantly, and eventually they zeroed in on Dennis Rader. Once they sort of had him as their suspect, police looked for additional links, and they discovered that he owned a black Jeep Cherokee, which matched the vehicle that was seen near multiple BTK crime scenes. They also obtained a DNA sample from one of the BTK killer's daughters, and that DNA sample matched evidence from a BTK murder site. So that confirmed the connection. But they wouldn't have gotten there without that metadata leading them to a specific person. And then they were able to corroborate that with other pieces of evidence. Anyways, all of this culminated in the arrest of Dennis Rader on February 25th, 2005, which ended the 30-year manhunt for him. And TLDR, his own arrogance and lack of understanding of forensics really led to his downfall.
So we've talked a lot about metadata. So let's talk about that in a little bit more detail, because this is where forensics and e-discovery kind of overlap. Metadata is really the blueprint of your data. In the case of the BTK killer, metadata was the crucial clue that finally led Dennis Rader's arrest after 3 decades of evasion. When we're talking about metadata that's used in investigations, what we're talking about are in several different categories. One of them might be file metadata. So things like timestamps. When was this document created? When was it modified? When was it last accessed? We are talking about the author or the last user details. We're talking about the file path. Where was this saved? On somebody's computer, on a network share, on a floppy disk, on a drive? And what was the storage location? We're also talking about document metadata, which is embedded text, like history of the document. When was it last revised? How many versions are there? Did Angie start it, then Brie gave a version, then Angie did another version? Who knows?
Now who's revealing our podcasting secrets?
And then Angie had 10 more versions after that.
Oh my God, I'm sorry. I feel attacked.
I'm just playing. And are there hidden properties revealing the device, software, or user details? Then we have like email data. Who was a sender? Who was a recipient? Who was CC'd? Who was BCC'd? What was the mail server logs and the routing details? Was it actually sent? When was it sent? And then even down to the IP address showing the geographic locations. When Brie sent this email, where was Angie when she received it? Image metadata. GPS coordinates can also be found on images sometimes whenever they're taken on cell phones or GPS-enabled cameras. The camera make and model and settings can also be found on some images. Web and social media metadata. We can find out browser and device tracking details, timestamp logs and edits and deletions, or hidden locations and IP tracking data can also be associated. The reason why this all matters is that, of course, it proves up the authenticity of our evidence. But really, the underlying reason is that it tells the rest of the story. It's much more than what we can tell with just an e-discovery collection. And let me just back up and explain what I mean by that. When we talk about collecting data from an e-discovery standpoint, a lot of times that's from a cloud resource like Microsoft or Google or Box.com or something like that. And even if it's not a cloud resource, even if it's on-prem, those collections are kind of static. They're like, hey, I'm going to go collect Angie's email, and now I have a picture of what's in her email from the date that I made that collection within the parameters that I applied to that collection. Maybe I'm collecting the last 3 months of her email, for example. But what we don't know is what's the rest of the story. I'm seeing email or I'm seeing documents that Angie had control of, but I don't know what she actually did with that. I don't know if she loaded that email to a thumb drive. I don't know if she loaded that email to an iCloud. I don't know what the heck she did with that. But when we talk about looking at forensic images and metadata, those are the things that we can figure out. It's important to protect the metadata. That's what we talk about when we're talking about chain of custody, is protection of that metadata to make sure that we have it so that we can track the history of what's going on. Investigators use metadata to verify authenticity, track digital footprints, and exposed deception in both criminal and corporate investigations. It's important that we have expertise when we're decoding metadata, what we are finding, and it's also important that that expertise is someone who can testify in court.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, to you or me, it's just gobbledygook, right? It's computer speak. And so you need somebody who speaks that language. Before digital forensics, BTK had successfully evaded capture for decades using, you know, these traditional deception tactics. And without that metadata, his floppy disk would have just been another anonymous clue. But this case really proves the power of digital footprints in solving major crimes and set a precedent for future cyber forensic investigations.
So yes, we're talking about metadata as it relates to the BTK killer, but it's important to note that metadata has a major role in all investigations and all litigation and all matters that we're talking about in an e-discovery world. We've talked about this in many of our episodes, and I encourage you to go back and listen to things like ESI protocol or review, because when we are using the term metadata, what we're really talking about is normalizing data so that it can be easily filtered, reviewed, labeled, and produced, and reported on, for that matter, by parties. Metadata is the way that we are taking all of the fields, like the who and the how and the dates and the where it came from and all the labels that we're putting on it. We are able to put that in a way that we can easily sort it and efficiently manipulate that data. So I would encourage you to go back to some of our previous episodes from last year where we talk about metadata in great detail. But it's an important part of e-discovery, which also makes this case of the BTK killer such a landmark case.
Yeah, absolutely. But all of this gathering, collecting evidence to actually find BTK, that's sort of, we're halfway to our destination, because the second half of this journey involves ensuring that that evidence is admissible. Because all of this is well and good, but if you can't actually use that evidence in court to prove that you found the right person, then that becomes a big problem for your case. So like any evidence, forensic evidence is only valuable if it's admissible, if it can hold up in court. And law enforcement here knew that mishandling the floppy disk could allow Dennis Rader's defense team to challenge its validity. And then it's sort of a house of cards from there. So to prevent any legal loopholes or accusations of evidence tampering, detectives followed a strict digital forensics protocol to ensure that the disk's data was preserved, analyzed, and authenticated in a manner that would make it legally admissible. So Bree, can you talk a little bit more about that? Because you are the queen of chain of custody.
Okay.
Don't threaten her with a good time.
I kind of feel like a sucker right now, but I will talk about this. So admissibility. One of the reasons why this evidence, of course, was able to be admitted, and what we all need to keep in mind when we're thinking about e-discovery or forensic matters that we're working on, is chain of custody. Okay, I've gone on so many soapboxes about this, and so I'm not going to do that tonight, I promise.
Never enough.
I mean, you could always give me a couple martinis and I'll go on about it for a few hours, but no. So chain of custody is important. When that purple disc came in, they had to document, you know, hey, this is where I got it from. This is what it looked like. I take a picture of it. We have to tag it, bag it. And more importantly, what we're going to do is we're going to create a forensic image of that disc. What we do when we create a forensic image is that we write block that so that we can prevent any kind of alteration to that image. So it's important if you in your own investigations are dealing with a data source that you, number one, are properly documenting where did you get it from? When did you get it? What state was it in when you received it? And then number two, that you're creating a forensically ironclad copy of that data in a way that you can analyze it that's not going to threaten the integrity of the actual native data itself. So the way that we might do that with the floppy disk, which who needs to know this anymore? I don't even know. We would write block that to prevent alteration, and we would have a bit by bit forensic image of that disk. Then we extract and authenticate the metadata. So when we have something that's ironclad, we've preserved that image so we know that nothing can happen to it. It can't be damaged. We preserve the chain of custody so we can prove up to the judge, this is where we got it from. This is who had it. This is where all it's been. Now we need that the metadata that has to do with that information that is on the disk or on the PC or on the phone or whatever device we're talking about. We need that metadata so then we can go back and do some analysis. Who was talking? What were they talking about? What were these files? When were they accessed, et cetera? And then you're going to be able to prepare that evidence for court.
That is my favorite little soapbox. So law enforcement anticipated that BTK's defense team would likely challenge the admissibility of the floppy disk evidence. And so to counter any arguments of evidence mishandling or tampering, they ensured that they adhered to standard digital forensics protocols. The investigators in this case followed best practices established by NIST, or the National Institute of Standards and Technology, and the federal rules of evidence, specifically Rule of Evidence 901, which deals with authentication. Authentication, just as a quick refresher, is just you're proving the evidence is what it appears to be. Another thing that law enforcement did to foreclose challenges to admissibility was keep detailed forensics reports. So in this case, they documented every step from collection through analysis. They documented it, timestamped it, and kept it in an official forensic report. And then they also kept chain of custody logs, which proved who handled the disk and when, and eliminated any doubts about contamination. These are things that law enforcement still does to this day when they're handling evidence. Now, the final thing that law enforcement did in this case was they got expert testimony from a digital forensic analyst. A forensic examiner who worked on this case would have been called to testify in court and then explained why, in layman's terms, the metadata proved the reliability of the findings on that floppy disk. So that rounds out our discussion. Bree, what are your key takeaways from this for e-discovery professionals and enthusiasts?
So when I think about this, some takeaways I have is, number one, metadata. And I'm sorry, I feel like we're beating a dead horse a little bit. Like if I had a dollar for every time I said metadata in this episode, I'd be rich. But it really is a digital footprint. And it's something that we all need to consider how important it is with our evidence. And there's ways of documenting chain of custody. And I think that sometimes we take this for granted. We're talking about a physical acquisition like a disk or a PC or a hard drive or a phone. There is a very standard protocol of what that chain of custody looks like. And sometimes it's a very physical and manual process. But we also have that same process when it comes to collecting directly from cloud resources like Microsoft or Box.com or Google or Slack or Teams or whatever it is, there still needs to be a chain of custody. So if you're not aware of how you are preserving that chain of custody when you're collecting, I would just encourage you to dig deeper into what your processes are to make sure that you are accurately conserving that information. Because one day it will become very important when you get to the court or you get to the judge and you have to prove up, how did I get this? How do I know it's real? How do I know it's authentic? When we think about AI and we think about where the future is going, it's going to become very, very, very important that we can prove authenticity of what our evidence is. And chain of custody is the heart of where that resides. So please, 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 make sure that you understand how you are able to authenticate what you are actually presenting as evidence. And metadata, make sure that you are preserving it in its truest form. So when I say that, I mean, make sure that you are taking every step that you can to collect data from its native application when it is possible. If it is not possible, then make sure that you are protecting the metadata. It is not cool when you get data that's if Angie's hey, we're in a lawsuit and I have some stuff that might be relevant And so I'm going to
stuff and things.
Yeah, some stuff and things. And I'm going to load it to a Google Drive. And so if you don't mind just like downloading that, because that's going to be your evidence that you're going to submit in court. And I go to that Google Drive and all the metadata is jacked up because now it says that Angie's the author. And now it says that the create date is today and the last modified date is today. Well, that doesn't really help me preserve that data source. So please think about that as you're moving forward with how you're litigating and how you're using evidence. The other takeaway I would say is remember that even deleted data isn't truly gone. Forensic tools are able to recover and analyze metadata long after the file was removed. And that's why I have so much respect for law enforcement and our forensic professionals who can go in there and look at those remnants of that data to help us tell a story. It's important that we have a game plan ahead of time. If I am in a corporate setting and I'm thinking ahead of time, like, hey, I might have devices, I might have things that I'm going to need a forensic expert to help me with. Who is that expert? Who is that team internally? And if I have to go external, who would those people be? And let's go ahead and establish what our workflow is going to be. What will our chain of custody look like? What do you need from me? What do we need to do and what do we not need to do? And what do we need to make sure that we protect? Being able to have those conversations ahead of time will save you a lot of heartache when you find yourself in the position of like, holy crap, we have this amazing like thing that's happening and now the police are involved and I don't even know what to do right now. Be very proactive.
Yeah, I think my takeaway, so one of my very good friends in law school was a public defender for quite a while. And he described proving a crime like a train route. And he would say, you know, when you start on your investigation, that is your birth. And then you go along stops along the way to your destination. And if at any point there is a chink in the track, the train will not reach its destination. And he used to use that metaphor when he was doing closing arguments like to juries. And then he would say how there were chinks in the track along the way. And that's why the jury should render a not guilty verdict. But I think that that's really a beautiful metaphor here because at every point along the way, every step of this investigation was so critical. And at any point, a mishandling of any of this metadata, a mishandling of the floppy disk, an error in the chain of custody is a chink in that track that will keep the train from reaching its destination. And in this case, all the victims of BTK would not have gotten the justice that they so rightly deserved had everybody not been so astute along the way.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So, all right, folks, I think that's all the time we have today. Thank you so much for joining us on eDiscovery Chicks. We hope you learned something new, felt empowered, or just had some fun along the way. Don't forget to join the flock by following us on LinkedIn and Instagram and check out our website, eDiscoveryChicks.com. If you loved this episode, share it with your network, leave us a review, or tag us on socials with your favorite takeaway. And don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you never miss an episode. Catch us next time. Until then, flock on, friends.
The views we've expressed today are the eDiscovery Chicks views and don't necessarily represent the views of our employers, partners, or clients. The podcast is available solely for educational purposes to provide general information about the eDiscovery principles and not to provide legal advice to any specific situation. It is not a substitute or for legal advice from a lawyer you've retained who has agreed to represent you. Bye, guys.
Bye.